I have the pleasure of introducing Jason Sigvardsson. Did I get close? Thank you. He's a senior policy and strategy advisor at the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS Geneva, and he's going to be talking to us about HIV-related discrimination and stigma, really with a focus on how do we get to zero. So thank you very much. You'll see me start to panic.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks so much. It's just really such a just great honor to be here. So many heroes, icons, inspirations really in this work, following a very tough act, and I include Catherine as those inspirations in this work. Just to say also thank you to IAPAC, the co-chairs. Congratulations on the 30th anniversary. I think Jose's letter and his remarks earlier also, just the spirit of what this group of people embodies, really carrying forward the work of Jonathan Mann and so many others, from the very, very earliest days of this response, saying that marginalization, exclusion, the punitive urge, all these things have to be resisted, and we have to go down to those root causes if we're going to be successful. Just also want to thank and acknowledge IAPAC, too, for all the great work, and many people in this room that are also pushing to engage local city leadership for the Fast Track Cities initiative. We're really hopeful that this will be another big opportunity to take on disparities and really, at the closest possible level to where people are and where clinics are and services are, really build inclusive societies, and HIV really being a driver for all the bigger challenges that we know are out there. So just to come back to our context, Fast Track, Ambassador Burks outlined at the beginning really that challenge, that imperative, if we're going to fast track the response, if we're going to front load our investments in this critical window, these 5 years, what would it look like if we're going to really bring down, as she pointed to the graph, get ourselves on the blue line that will put us down to 200,000 new infections a year. What will it take so that we're on track to end the epidemic by 2030? Just to say, of course, when we talk about the Fast Track agenda, we're guided by our vision of three zeros, one of those zeros being zero discrimination. Now, it's there because it's the right thing to do, it's a necessary thing to do. We need to take on the pain, the suffering, the just injustice that continues to happen in the epidemic. But we also know it's critical for achieving and advancing the other two zeros on prevention and treatment. So what we often say, there's no fast track without human rights. And if we want to be really serious about this agenda, we have to put the human rights issues on the fast track. Just to say also in this work, we talk about 90-90-90 as a challenge, a milestone, something that's really driving our efforts. And in all of this, of course, we need to be, very much, as many people are saying, focused also on the 10-10-10, because it's invariable that we know who will be left behind if we don't have that just constant focus on making sure that our approaches are inclusive and recognize that people are in different situations. That also applies to how we think about our work on stigma and discrimination. Some of you have seen my son, my older son, who's almost five, who was here, and he was hovering over me as I was looking at my slides this morning. And he, of course, when we came to the picture slide, he said, "Well, there's children there. There's children, there's boys and girls. So are you going to talk about boys and girls? Talk about boys and girls." And so I was joking with a couple of people before that, I think he's been probably, being plied with ice cream from some of our key advocates. But of course, on this issue, we have to think about stigma and discrimination also affecting children differently, affecting them, where they go to school, affecting, how their parents' HIV status may be affecting, how teachers are treating them, how other classmates are treating them. So we really have to think also in this agenda, really thinking about how stigma and discrimination is affecting people differently. What I want to do is just touch on what, we often see as kind of some of the five key imperatives of really driving this agenda to get to zero. So I want to talk about the leadership of people living with HIV, data-based approaches to really drive the action, building the coalitions and the focus that it takes to actually get progress, because you know these issues are not they're challenging issues. This will probably, as you know, Phil Wilson and others have said, this will be the toughest work yet, but it's not too big to solve. The investment we need in programs to actually increase access to justice and drive down stigma and discrimination, and then how we sustain the leadership and accountability. You know, just to say on the leadership of people living with HIV, you know, we've known and we've heard and been reminded many times in this room, it's been part of the story since the beginning of the epidemic, and it remains essential if we're going to fast track and reach the end of AIDS. And one of, you know, to me, one of the most just exciting developments in the past decade has been the work of led by the Global Network of People Living with HIV and ICW, supported by UNAIDS, the People Living with HIV Stigma Index. It's been implemented in over 80 countries now. Over 75,000 people living with HIV have participated in interviews. You know, where this has been most impactful is where networks are in a position to take their research and really use it to drive their advocacy and really drive what are the specific problems in the specific places, whether it's something going on in the clinic, whether it's happening in their faith communities, whether it's happening in the schools with their employers. You're driving the conversation, the change where it needs to happen. So, you know, often we talk about just the epi and we talk about the need for focus on location and population. And, you know, what we're increasingly saying when it comes to stigma and discrimination, we also have to think about location and population too. I think our data, you know, one thing that's also improved, I think, remarkably in the past decade is just, and there's still much more that needs to be done to get better data and better local data, but we do have better data about where stigma and discrimination is happening. So this graphic here is Côte d'Ivoire. You'll see also sub-regional data on where stigma and discrimination is happening. So the left-hand side, sorry for the small type, the left-hand side is the prevalence of stigmatizing attitudes in the general population, all very high. Even the low end is the brown color is 40 to 49%. Above 60% is the dark green. If you look on the right-hand side, you'll see uptake of testing. Now, if you look at some of the regions that are some of the dark green on the left, happen to be the gray areas on the right. The gray areas are less than 10% uptake of testing. So I think we also see where we have, you know, some of these most hostile attitudes, we also have some of the lowest uptake of services. So you're taking on stigma and discrimination is the right thing to do, but it's also we see these connections, and we need to really have that data that really enables us to go to the places where the problems are the worst. You know, Catherine's gone to detail on the challenge of criminalization, but and Anna flagged that there's also some more recent civil society data that's just come out. But this is data that comes from HIV Justice Network and the Global Network of People Living with HIV. The top 30 jurisdictions in the world in terms of number of known arrests and prosecution and incarceration based on non-disclosure or transmission or exposure. So just to say, we're in Florida, so Florida has the distinction of being the jurisdiction in the world that has the highest number of known prosecutions. Moving on to just the need for focus and coalitions. So, you know, Catherine's outlined just, you know, the amazing groundswell that we've seen recently of groups coming together, pushing for laws that reflect the science and reflect fundamentally reflect justice in the context of the epidemic. We've also seen, you know, and I think it's that kind of impatience with the injustice. You know, we need the sense of urgency that drives the action. Just, you know, two other examples. The kind of impatience that we saw around HIV-related entry, stay, and residence restrictions around the world, or otherwise known as travel restrictions. And a group of people in 2008, you know, really reached out and said, you know, we've known at that point for at least 20 years that this was ineffective. HIV was in all countries. It was transmitted by specific behaviors, and border restrictions and entry restrictions weren't going to be the way to actually do anything useful in the context of the public health. The only thing that was useful for public health purposes was prevention, treatment, care, and support for people on the move. So people came together, and you'll see, you know, by having a focused coalition to drive change, you know, at 2008, when there was the International Task Team on Travel Restrictions, you know, co-convened by UNAIDS in Norway, we had 59 countries, territories, and areas. And there's been country by country follow-up that's been able to, you know, in the 7-year period, drive down that number to 35 countries, territories, and areas. Still too many. And the work is ongoing. We need to keep driving to zero. But it's an example for an issue that some people said was too big to challenge with constituencies that don't understand HIV on an issue that's seen as, you know, very sensitive and matters of national sovereignty. But that coalition really driving a conversation to sensitize people and getting decision makers feeling that they're in a position to make the change. You know, the latest push, and a lot of it came from a lot of the data being collected by people living with HIV, the push for zero discrimination in healthcare. And so this is something where, you know, we're grateful for IOPAC's engagement. We hope there'll be many more opportunities to bring this agenda increasingly to national level. But this many years into the epidemic, at a time when we want one-stop shops, we want integrated care, yet if places where care are provided and mainstream care being provided are not inclusive spaces, we cannot hope to realize that vision of easy, integrated, accessible, one-stop shop care. I won't go into the details, but you know, just to say on, you know, it's a 7-part action plan. It's available on our website. But just to say that, you know, all of you in this room all are doing and have, you know, just so many opportunities to make crucial contributions to this agenda. You know, we're very, very grateful also for IOPAC's leadership in terms of the care continuum guidelines, you know, putting the legal environment really up front and the need to transform the legal environment to one that makes the care environment an inclusive space. The research also presented here, and you know, the question that in one of the abstract sessions, and Bruce's question on, you know, how do we take the research and drive a quality improvement agenda? You know, I think there's just so many opportunities from going to data to action and really tapping into your collective experience and the resources to really, you know, drive that vision and really get leadership also right down to the clinic and facility level, really seeing this as an opportunity and something that they see as making the best possible services available. What we often see, you're moving to the programmatic agenda, so again, it's not too big to solve, but it also means that we need to put resources, energy, and programs into doing the things that make a difference, whether it's Know Your Rights campaigns that are led by networks of people living with HIV, you know, bringing together the legal literacy with the treatment literacy, being able to engage healthcare providers, you know, both in terms of their own knowledge, but also at the facility level, the kind of accountability and monitoring mechanisms that are there also to support healthcare workers, engaging law enforcement, and as Catherine said, also the prosecutors, the judges, so they actually understand the epidemic and understand the science. So, you know, increasingly we're seeing, you know, national responses integrate these programs. And for us, it's, you know, very much something that, you know, it's integrated into our strategy as UNAIDS. And I think even beyond that, you know, one thing that's changed since last year is the adoption of the Sustainable Development Goals agenda. Within that agenda, you know, it sought to, in a sense, do two things to me that are interesting. One, it became an all-country agenda. So it was really, the message is that, you know, if we're going to achieve real sustainable development, it has to be outcomes for everybody, everywhere. The second one is really it elevated human rights. A lot of people said that the previous agenda, the Millennium Development Goals agenda, drove a lot of important progress, but often it focused mainly on low-income countries, middle-income countries, and it tended to have a bit of a human rights blind spot. So, you know, what we find exciting is, you know, the mainstream of development in the world is really pushing for a bigger focus on human rights, on access to justice, and these kind of programs. And I think that the kind of things we've known all along for many years in the HIV response have been doing for many years, the kind of alliances that happen where local health providers are working with local social service and legal providers. You know, those are kind of bread and butter kind of approaches. But for a lot of aspects of development, they're really kind of transformational. So, you know, our hope is really that, you know, in this next phase, as we fast track the human rights agenda, you know, that many people are looking to the HIV response for those kind of coalitions, the focused action, the activism, the leadership of officials. that really show hope and show progress and really bring many people together for the bigger kind of change that we need beyond HIV. The last of the five components, I want to touch on just the milestones we've had in political commitment over the years. And Jose mentioned the upcoming high-level meeting that's happening in the UN General Assembly. This is really something that every previous high-level meeting, the kind of outcome and commitment there really drives the agenda ahead. And what our hope is that this will really reinforce all the earlier commitments on human rights, but also take this another step further. We saw in 2011, for example, those key programs I mentioned were actually part of the political outcome. Nobody could ever say again that, well, these are kind of an add-on or a nice thing to do. It was really seen as fundamental approaches and programs that were needed for the success of the response. I think we see a draft document in circulation now that puts, I think, elevates the issues around criminalization, including criminalization of non-exposure, transmission. This is being actively negotiated right now, and this is really a critical moment for everybody to activate your own networks. People here have very strong international global networks. It's a time for researchers, providers, to making sure in different countries people are reaching out to their Ministry of Foreign Affairs, reaching out to their country's permanent mission to the United Nations in New York, and making sure that they're aware of the strong support of, and expectations of frontline providers, that these issues are given prominence, and that we're positioned for 5 years of real, serious effort, investment, and results. So I want to conclude just here with really, again, this is a very powerful, dedicated group of people that are frontline providers, but also just real, I think in that spirit of the early days and that Jonathan Mann spirit of really driving the kind of change that needs to happen. And as Catherine said, there's many, many long lists, but I think just to focus on four things, this window in the next kind of 3.5 weeks leading up to the high-level meeting during these negotiations, please do, if you're not already in touch with your foreign affairs people or your country's permanent mission in New York, do reach out either yourselves or as a coalition of groups from your countries to pass that message of your expectations for a strong outcome. Secondly, the many opportunities for joining and supporting the advocacy by networks of people living with HIV, networks of key populations, wherever there's a challenge to stigma and discrimination, challenging overly broad criminalization, challenging travel restrictions. It's just to have that voice of science and the frontline service provider experience is incredibly powerful, as Catherine and many others have pointed out. We'd love to have, just in so many places, facility level, national level, people joining this push for zero discrimination in healthcare settings. We have a global platform, and just to make this real, if we can have stories of results and coalitions coming together in individual facilities, this will really feed this, and I hope it will become one of the success stories in a few years where we're tracking the progress, we see the data, we see the change, and we see people talking about a different kind of inclusive care, particularly at a time when we're expecting there to be increased global energy and momentum for universal health care and universal health coverage, and increasing momentum for integration. From our perspective in the HIV response and in UNAIDS, integration and universal health care will be successful to the extent to which it fully includes everybody affected by HIV and leaves nobody behind. And then the last point, and Catherine and others have said this, but the need to sensitize media, elected officials, the public, for a much more accurate understanding of how HIV is and is not transmitted, the impact of treatment. This should be something that really permeates the public consciousness. This idea of a 96% protective effect of successful treatment. That should be really exciting news and a message that's out there for public consumption. We also need the message of just sustaining and building support for expanded HIV services, as the smart public health approach. You know, we know that there are many challenges. There's always the imperative, and we need to do make resources go further and stretch resources. But we really need to be seeing this as an investment in strong, resilient communities, strong, resilient health systems, and not being seen as a running cost or something to curtail or avoid. And I think we've captured in so many powerful ways the returns, whether you measure it on health terms, whether you measure it in inclusive communities, whether you measure it in justice. I think we have to keep on pushing that agenda, just keeping on making the case for why this is so important as just a collective global challenge and opportunity to end the epidemic by 2030, but also recognizing that if we do it well and do it right and truly leave nobody behind, this could radically catalyze so many important forms of progress that we need on so many other fronts. So I hope I've helped us also catch up a little bit of our time, but just thanks to everybody. It's been such a tremendous honor and pleasure, and look forward to continuing working together. Thank you.